Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call this Committee of Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, I just wanted to begin with the approval of the minutes for February 15th. Vice Chair Brennan, do you want to move the minutes for February 15th?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would be delighted to move the minutes from February 15th.
Vice Chair Brennan moves the approval of minutes of February 15, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for February 15, 2024 are now approved. With that, I just wanted to announce we have a new page, Michael Thomas, who will be assisting us. I just wanted you to welcome him to the committee. And our agenda today is very small agenda, but with a big intent, because this is a very significant issue that we've had the discussion last session. Without delaying the process, I wanted to welcome Commissioner Hofstede to the presentation table so we can begin the conversation about the Priority Admission Task Force report. And members, we will have a bill that will be coming before us. So this is more about the details, so you can ask more questions today. So when we get the bill, I'm hoping that it's going to be for a quick discussion. So with that, Commissioner Hofstede, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dodie Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and most recently, co-chair of the Priority Admissions Task Force. Delighted to come and present to you the results of the task force work. We met for the final time a week ago Friday and had unanimous approval of the report for all the members who are present in the room that day. A little bit of background so you know what it is we're talking about. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 253B allows for a person to be civilly committed to the care of the DHS commissioner for the purpose of receiving needed treatment and care. In 2010, the average wait time for admission to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center was 19 days. By 2013, the average wait time had jumped to 30 days, and the time from commitment order to placement had grown unacceptably long. The Priority Admissions Law, enacted in 2013, was intended to help law enforcement officials cope with the rising number of individuals with mental health issues, accused of crimes, being held in jail, and to get them quickly into a court-ordered treatment facility. The law included the 48-hour rule, requiring the commissioner to prioritize patients being admitted from jails and to admit them within 48 hours of their commitment. For the first few years, the statute resulted in quicker hospitalizations from jails. Now the number of civil commitments has risen by over 36% over the past 10 years, from 644 in 2013 to 2242 in 2023, making it impossible for DHS's direct care and treatment services to adhere to the 48-hour rule. The existence of the law has also led to a concentration of highly symptomatic patients more prone to aggressive behavior, filling DCT facilities while employees are seeking safer working conditions. So many patients from jails filling the DCT wait list that today, civilly committed patients waiting in hospitals and community have virtually no hope of being admitted. A raft of lawsuits requiring DHS to comply with the 48-hour rule, while the department has argued that it is impossible. The 48-hour rule was amended by the legislature last year for a two-year period to allow DCT to admit patients from jails 48 hours after a medically appropriate bed becomes available instead of 48 hours after commitment. It also gave counties a two-year stay from fees for does-not-meet-criteria patients being transferred between DCT facilities instead of out to the community. Counties have long been charged fees for does-not-meet-criteria patients waiting to go out to community to encourage them to find community placements. But they've also been charged for patients being transferred between facilities, and that's been suspended until 2025. One very effective thing that the task force did was that several members of the task force were able, the day before their first meeting, to tour both the Anoka County Jail and the Hennepin County Emergency Department, sharing their eye-opening experiences on the first day of the task force that helped them to understand various sides of the concerns. The task force guiding principles you can see here. Lack of timely access and capacity are clearly a problem. All people living with mental health disorders are entitled to have care when and where they need it. Transparency builds trust. And we had to discuss an honest appraisal of the need, not constrained by budgetary limitations, even though we had all heard the new forecast. And so as we were trying to wrap this report up, there was a lot of discussion and debate about how much to acknowledge the forecast and how much to simply talk about what needs to be done, should be done. And so you'll see some of that in the final recommendations. And then you can see the rest of the task force guiding principles, which helped us with our work. The task force also had a robust discussion of the balance between DCT capacity for treating patients with behavioral health needs and community provider capacity in behavioral health. While many advocates have said for decades that we need to build community capacity versus state hospital capacity, it is clear with the dramatic increased prevalence of serious unmet behavioral health needs everywhere across Minnesota coming out of the pandemic that we need to add capacity everywhere. We need to increase behavioral health pay rates and rebuild our behavioral health workforce in community settings. And we do need additional capacity at DCT, whose mission is to serve those civilly committed to its care and those whom others cannot or will not serve. This was the charge to the task force out of last year's session to evaluate the impact of priority admission under Minnesota law of the state's ability to serve all individuals in need of care of state-operated services. Analyze the impact of priority admission on the mental health system in the state of Minnesota. Provide recommendation for improvements or alternatives to the current priority admission requirements. Identify and provide recommendations for providing treatment to individuals referred under the priority admission requirements, as well as other individuals in the community who require treatment at a state-operated treatment program. Task force members, Keith Ellison, the Attorney General, and I were the co-chairs of the task force. Members included representatives from Direct Care and Treatment, several representatives from various county positions, including a county commissioner, someone from the County Sheriff's Association, the County Attorneys Association, Human Services, et cetera. We had people from hospitals. We had people from behavioral health community organization representatives. The Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, a couple of people appointed by Governor Walz, and a couple of people appointed by the Commissioner of Corrections. And here were the recommendations that we agreed to on our last day a week ago, Friday. To immediately begin to increase direct care and treatment capacity and access. To increase capacity of the forensic mental health program by 10 to 20%. Increase capacity at the NOCA Metro Regional Treatment Community Behavioral Health Hospital level of care by 20%. Increased capacity can be achieved through the addition of beds and staffing, renovation, construction, reallocation of beds and staff, or a combination of all these. As I mentioned, we had the debate about whether to recognize the current forecast or ignore it, and this is aspirational in terms of what really needs to be done, but we also know that you're dealing with fiscal constraints this session. Recommendation two was to start a joint incident collaboration, including county, community providers, DHS, and DCT partners to engage in arranging discharges more actively for DCT patients who are ready for discharge. Just a note here that DCT currently has 46 patients who do not meet criteria for hospital treatment in DCT who need to find spaces in community settings to allow many more patients to be admitted into the front door at DCT. I will share that this joint collaboration is already going on across state government and is beginning to reach out now to include the counties in the conversation on a very regular basis. There was a meeting last week with 22 providers from the community where the staff de-identified and described 13 kinds of cases that are in DCT today and got a great response from the providers who are willing to take a look at bringing people into their services. We've been doing this work now for over a year, and we're finding what some of the barriers are and starting to find that within state government we can solve some of those problems. That group also has the Whatever It Takes fund that has about $10 million in it right now that they can turn to renovate buildings and take care of other kinds of expenses if that's helpful to move people out of DCT. Recommendation 3 was to approve an exception to the current priority admissions law by immediately approving an exception for up to 10 civilly committed individuals waiting in a hospital to be added to the priority admissions waitlist at DCT, with admissions being managed according to the prioritization framework that we will show you in Recommendation 4. And just a note, there are 10 civilly committed patients who have waited in hospitals for admission for over 6 months now. And the plan is, should they be added to the admissions list, then we would begin to look at this approach to deciding who gets into DCT for now and ongoing. First, any change to the priority admissions law must occur simultaneously to or following the immediate increase in capacity at DCT as referenced in recommendation number 1. And then individuals civilly committed as mentally ill, chemically dependent, mentally ill and dangerous, and developmentally disabled will be prioritized by physicians in the executive medical director's office for admission to DCT into medically appropriate beds using an established prioritization framework which takes several factors into account. This publicly available framework will allow for transparency. And here it is. People would be looking at the length of time spent on the wait list, intensity of treatment needed due to their medical acuity, their provisional discharge status, the current safety of the individual and others in the proximal environment, access to or lack thereof to essential or court-ordered treatment elsewhere, other negative impacts to the referring facility, such as number of beds unavailable because of caring for the particular referred individual, and any relevant federal prioritization requirements. So instead of prioritizing all people coming from jails first and then hospitals and community, these would be the ongoing factors. And the rest of recommendation 4 is that a panel of members from the Priority Admissions Task Force will review de-identified data quarterly for a year following implementation of the new framework to ensure the prioritization framework is carried out in a fair and equitable manner. And at the end of the year, this task will fall to a newly established quality committee, which will provide a routine report to the DCT Board of Directors as DCT becomes a separate agency. Recommendation 5 is to increase access to services provided in the community by expanding access to intensive residential treatment services, also known as IRTS, level of care, to allow locked programming and extended programming, and working with the Minnesota Congressional Delegation to have CMS allow Medicaid for locked IRTS. To fund services at levels recommended in the behavioral health rate study to retain current providers, to fund voluntary engagement pilot programs and study their efficacy, to support strategies to decrease the timeline for the completion of the MIN choices assessments, and to expand access to assertive community treatment and forensic assertive community treatment services. The rest of recommendation 5 is to expand first episode of psychosis programs and pilot first episode of bipolar disorder programs, focus on alternatives to police responses by building and stabilizing funding for crisis response teams, publicizing the new 988 phone number, and fully implementing Travis's Law. To support mental health workforce through increasing compensation, providing free supervision, expanding training opportunities for integrated substance use disorder and mental illness, and developing measures to reduce violence in the workplace. And finally, to expand the Sick and Safe Law to include mental health leave benefits for frontline workers. And as a note, many of these recommendations have been made before in the 6 or 7 prior task force reports that are included in the appendix of the new task force report. Recommendation 6 is about administering medication in jails. We all agree that jails are not a replacement for mental health hospitals or secure treatment facilities, and the recommendation is to provide funding mechanisms to effectively administer mental health medications to individuals in jail custody, to pay for training, medication, the services of an individual qualified to deliver the medication, and administrative costs. Funding should be provided to DHS-DCT to support efforts to access mental health medications in jails, including expert consultation, education, coordination, and a list of suitable providers for medication administration. In other words, as DCT is able to develop a list of suitable providers across the state, jails across the state could call them to come in and administer medication. And finally, that an inmate receiving mental health medication in jail should not have a copay. Recommendation 7 is to relieve counties of certain DNMC costs. So as I mentioned, in the 2-year interim solution for this law, the counties were relieved of does not meet criteria costs for people awaiting transfer to DCT programs. when the executive medical director's office deems the individual meets criteria and DCT is the only provider that can reasonably serve. And we added to relieve the counties of DNMC costs when awaiting transfer to a Department of Corrections facility. And finally, a recommendation that we redirect and reinvest does not meet criteria payments to support development of community services versus reversion back to the general fund. Recommendation 8 is that DHS should complete the application for an 1115 Medicaid demonstration waiver to facilitate individuals in custody to receive Medicaid benefits so that treatment can be subsidized within a correctional setting and allow for robust discharge services to be arranged. The waiver should focus on allowing access to Medicaid for individuals in custody within 90 days of release and all individuals in pretrial status. We received some funding to explore this 1115 waiver earlier, and we're deep into the examination of the ability to do this 1115 waiver here in Minnesota. And recommendation 9 is to increase forensic examiner accessibility. The rate of reimbursement for forensic examiners who conduct Rule 20 examinations should be increased. The rate of pay should be commensurate with the time to complete the examination and the associated liability that the examiner holds, and introductions of efficiencies in the Rule 20 process, such as screening examinations, should be implemented. That's our final recommendation. And as I mentioned, the task force came together for an hour a week ago Friday to finalize the last recommendations and to vote. They all agreed to stay for an extra hour until we reached the point where it was unanimous for the people in the room to approve the final report of the task force. So that's my report, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. I just wanted to begin by saying thank you to the task force that put together the report and for their dedication and their work that they did. This is incredible work, and we appreciate what they did. I know there are several questions. Some of my members have questions. We'll start with Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thank you for presenting this and for serving as a co-chair. I know in conference committee last year, this was a long discussion that we really didn't have any answers to. I hope this provides some sort of roadmap. I guess I think the biggest thing that's the obvious one for everybody is you know, we just need more beds, more capacity as soon as possible to give you more breathing room, to give us more breathing room. What does 20% mean, Commissioner, if we were to get 20% more beds? Can you give me an idea what that means? I know it comes with more workforce, but how many beds, if you could give me a roundabout of 20%, what does that look like?
I do not have that data. Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Rep. Baker. I don't have that data with me here today. We'll have to get back to you. But it's a significant increase, as you can see. And it would take some budget to get there, for
Thank
sure.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
I think, Representative Baker, as you've had, this is aspirational in terms of
right.
budget. We know that the expectation, we don't have resources to spend during this session. But I think there are so many ways that we can do this because most of this program is Medicaid funded, and we have some ways of working with other institutions who are able to provide care. But I'm more interested in the hospital. We've had more than 10 people, not only 6 months. I know some people have been there for more than 2 years just waiting to be admitted because of the rules, the way they're set up, that they don't get the priority. We start with the jails. How many do we have currently waiting in the jails to be admitted? Do you know any number?
The last time I saw that number, it was 114 or so. I wonder, Carrie, do you know if you could you ask someone? It's over 100, that's for sure, and has been for some time now.
So we have 46 that are ready to be discharged to other settings. We have 10 who are waiting in the hospitals, and we have got 100 and some who are waiting in jail. So that means it's a significant number of people who are already on the waiting list. And those who will be added to the waiting list, because we're just taking a picture of where we are today, but anything can change in the next few days or months or years to come. So we've got a lot of work to do. And I'm more interested in the structural changes whereby we can start moving staff and changing some of that process and even moving some of those individuals who are ready to be moved to a lesser restrictive environment. Can we achieve some of those goals without having the budget?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there are several recommendations here that don't require any budget. The first is this priority incident collaboration that we were talking about. We've been working at it for some time. We've learned about what some of the barriers are. Our heroes have been the group home sector of providers who are willing to take folks with high needs like this. And they're not just beginning to learn how to do that. They've been doing it now for some years. And so when we ask them what it would take to gear up to take these kinds of patients, they tell us what they did the last 10 times they took folks like this. And so that sector has come a long way. They're able to add, if they need it, a one-person group home, a two-person group home, et cetera. And so there's a lot of possibility in that sector being able to take some of the folks out of DCT. And our recent provider meeting was evidence of that. And in terms of the number of providers who raised their hand and said, yes, let me know how many folks that I can take. And so that was a positive thing. We know that staffing is an issue everywhere, and it's not easy, and we're not expecting to suddenly move everyone next week. It's going to take some slogging through, looking for folks to take people, and then some wait time until the provider is ready and staffed and able to take people. But we are optimistic about our ability to improve the rate of discharges from DCT. And one other thing I just want to mention about that is we talk about DCT like everything's stuck and no one's getting in and no one's getting out. And in fact, we admit about 10 to 20 priority admissions people off that wait list every month. So there are people coming in and there are people going out. We just need more people coming in and more people going out. So we're trying to make that flow go faster as medically required, and also have just more people coming in and more people going out. The recommendation for the exception to the priority admissions rule to have the 10 hospital patients admitted is this one is another no cost. It's just a matter of reordering the priority list. And then the creation of the new priority admissions criteria for the long term would not cost anything. But as you see, the task force wanted to say that that was subject to additional capacity. So it would require the capacity investment first. This recommendation of increasing access to services in the community clearly has a budget expectation. Administering medications in jails has a small budget request to give us some additional staffing in DCT to support it, but not very large, less than $1 million. This would have a budget impact in terms of county saving dollars from the state budget.
So that was about $13 million that we invested, so that the counties can save the resources due to the PNMC. So just wanted to put that we funded the counties last year.
And creating the waiver is already in the works and in good shape. And so we don't need to spend money to create the waiver. And then putting it in place and getting started is another question.
Looking forward to the reentry waiver. We have a discussion coming up in the next 2 weeks on the 1115 waiver for the reentry.
And then increasing accessibility for forensic examiners has a budget implication.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. This might be slightly off topic, but I just want to mention again that we also have children sitting in hospitals and in juvenile detention mm-hmm. centers that aren't reflected necessarily here. And so mm-hmm. if we can't find the appropriate place for the children now when they become adults, we're still going to be having, you know, similar conversations about them. So I kind of want to always bring up our kids that are stuck in these spaces too, because I think we end up talking a lot about the adults, and a hospital is nowhere for a child who's mentally ill to be stuck for months and years.
That's right. I just read a report at the end of December from the Children's Mental Health Collaborative, who suggests that they were instrumental in helping 200 children move from hospitals this last year. Mm-hmm. And we're working to put this effort together with that effort and get a better picture of everybody in Minnesota who's been stuck in hospitals and wanting to move.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm not sure if my colleagues would appreciate an update on that work, the collaboration work component, but I really would. I'd love to hear how we're going to blend and braid this together to really work to change the system.
I think we're all interested in that data, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. it should be sent to the committee if that is available. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, if we instantaneously funded all the recommendations, what are we looking at for the staffing shortage to actually implement?
Commissioner.
So, Chair Noor and Representative, we haven't done the math on putting a budget on this yet. There's a group meeting this afternoon, I believe, to put together bill language, and then we'll be doing a fiscal note and figuring out what that would all mean. Is that your question? Is it the fiscal question?
Representative Kwan.
No, the point is being that whatever the dollars come up, the overcoming the issue of a lack of trained personnel and staff to actually implement it.
Right.
So we magically find a pot of gold and we fund this. That is not the, you know, success unless we have procedurally implemented plans that we could actually staff. Because I think everywhere we seem to have a shortage of people.
Yes, Rep. Noor and Representative, that's obviously a key question here. DCT has been fairly successful in filling the staff positions that it has and maintaining its staff fairly well in these settings. There is a unit that's closed because they haven't been able to staff it. They're considering just giving it a try again to see if they can fill that up and add some capacity that way. But that is a challenge. On the other hand, they've done fairly well with that, and we need to continue looking for solutions to that, just as we're also looking for solutions to community capacity. So can't snap our fingers and produce staff, but there have been efforts to fill positions in these services that have gone fairly well.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. And building off of Representative Hicks' statement, and you know, in the report and discussions, that's why the 48 hours is in there, is you quickly get support and you prevent long-term or chronic issues. You help them quickly. And we're really addressing the results. And I think part of the cause is our issues with children, and in the school system. I think a side effect of decreasing the competitive activities is we also are missing the team building activities that allow children to feel part of a group, a community, working together, and that the coping skills they gain by interactions that decrease isolation, I think would, you know, 10 years down the line, decrease the quantity and population that we're seeing. So while you're addressing the result of many things, I think, you know, we in the legislature have to look at how can we do this and then also help the future, you know, in the schools. So that just, that's more meant for thought for us sitting around this, you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have Chair Fisher next.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today, and thank you so much for the task force, for everyone on the task force, for the work they put in. It's helpful because this starts giving some of the information I've been trying to find out is what do we need to start building out for capacity in the system, and it's helpful to start seeing what's needed from DCT to make that happen. What I was wondering is you're mentioning that you still have that bottleneck of discharge. And what I was wondering is where the different areas, you know, I was kind of hearing group homes, but how much of that is psychiatric residential treatment facilities? How much of it is urgent? How much, you know, what parts of the continuum that is it each of those or what percentage or how much of did those each component come into being backed up because they couldn't take people that you had?
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Chair Fisher, all the above. And, you know, the folks who do the discharges have been looking for placements. The counties have been looking for placements. And so we appreciate everybody's efforts to continue to try to move people across the system. What we have found by stepping in and creating a really proactive approach in state government to literally help find placements for specific people is the some of the barriers. And so some of the barriers are unclear guardianship arrangements. They are pending MA eligibility, which our MA people can do something about. For children, it's been children also engaged in the child protection system. Well, we can work with our colleagues in our own children and family services to help understand what needs to happen there for children to be able to move. Healthcare plans that pay for bariatric services but not bariatric equipment. And so there's some things we've discovered that we think the Whatever It Takes Fund might be helpful with, and then just working through the bureaucracy of the interconnected services and policy areas is one of the things that we are hoping to do to move things more quickly.
Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Commissioner. That helps it in those areas. One of the questions I would have also is that in some of the areas, whether it's group homes or if it's the psychiatric residential treatment facilities or IRTS facilities, do we need more capacity in those, or do some of those, are we at risk at losing some of those? And what I'm getting at is we do a real good job of paying for ongoing things, but sometimes we've got capital items that come in or one-time requests that may not always be covered by the traditional funding sources out there. Are there things that need to be done in that area that we could be addressing, that, you know, using one-time dollars that we might have a little bit more flexibility on that might help with some of these issues?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Noor and Chair Fisher. My sense is most of those services are very full up because they took people first, and we're looking now at the group homes to move some more people. But absolutely, I mean, and as we get even more organized as an internal staff and working closely with providers, we'll be able to get even clearer about where the gaps are and where we could see more capacity. But right now, the answer is we need capacity everywhere. Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. And one other question I have or thought is, I know that staffing is a huge issue. I know that sometimes we've been kind of limited as where we've been looking at how to recruit people in. Are there ways that, like I know we get federal dollars that come in on mental health block grants and that type of thing, are there ways to take some of those kind of dollars to help pay recruitment bonuses or hire recruitment firms to go to other states and recruit people from other states, using that type of thing to try to say, hey, come to Minnesota, we've got a good outlay, we're going to be here to take care of you. And I think the state offers things other states don't that would be very attractive to people, and that might be one way to, well, it puts the pressure on other parts of the country, start helping solve the problem here.
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Chair Fisher, good idea. Haven't worked as much recently on the areas of how to get more people into this kind of work, but that's very helpful. One thing I want to add, and you'll find in the report, is we also had a pretty good conversation about the prevalence of behavioral health issues. And as Rep. Kwan mentioned, we're not only talking about less capacity and workforce shortage, we have a higher prevalence of behavioral health since the pandemic. And isolation, absolutely, for older adults and for children and everyone in between is one of the issues. We even heard a little bit from physicians on the panel about how having had COVID is somehow connected with a higher prevalence of behavioral health concerns. And so there's something there that I don't think medical science has quite parsed out yet, but there's some indication of that. And so clearly we're dealing with a higher prevalence of behavioral health issues and the workforce shortage and the capacity issues. So you put them all together, and it's just going to take us really working hard together for some time to work our way back to a place where things are moving more smoothly.
Commissioner, how's the pay for employees or workers who work in this setting? Is it up to par with the market rate, or are we paying enough to those who work in DCT and other settings?
Chair Noor, It's not. So we just finished the behavioral health rate study recently, and that will show you how that looks and how those rates compare to others. And so the behavioral health entire space has not kept up with the funding we have for physical health in this country, even though it was Minnesota congressional leaders who talked about behavioral health parity decades ago. We're not there yet, so that's another challenge.
I'm the real Representative Clardy. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for your work on the task force. I wanted to look at the recommendation seven and just had, or six, I guess, and just had some questions about what's going on now, basically. So who's, like right now, who's monitoring the medication that's distributed, and then who's doing it, and then the whole piece about copay just really is amazing. So what has been happening to the patients that have needed copays? Are they just not getting medication? And then the last thing is, how is this going to go into effect, the transition in this piece?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Norr and Representative Clark. I am not an expert on how things go in jails. Can I phone a friend? Is there anyone here that represents that sector that could speak to that? No. All right.
We'll bring an expert soon who will be talking about this area. So
yes, what we did learn in the conversation on the task force is that there's a wide spectrum from very sophisticated work in the Hennepin County jail system in collaboration with Hennepin County Medical Center to some counties that really struggle with dealing with medication in jails, and hence this recommendation to support that, beef that up, and to provide an ability for people to come in and do that medication administration. And then there's been, for many years, reluctance by Medicaid, for example, to pay for services while someone's incarcerated. And so that's a general barrier across all of our corrections facilities. And so this would at least deal with the copay question on that. And so we see lots of different things across all 87 counties, and that needs to be stronger while people are even on the wait list before they get a chance to come into DCT so they can come in stronger and healthier in the first place.
I think that corresponds to the Medicaid inmate exclusion, because it's a policy, it's a federal process. So I think as we talk about the 1115 waiver to allow for 90 days before entry, that will help significantly. We're only talking about 90 days. We're not talking about the entire time. And it's a waiver, demonstration waiver, that is being allowed. So we'll try and see if we can get that as part of making sure inmates can get medication and support before they re-enter into the society. I have Representative Zalesnica on the list.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I guess my question is wondering on some data. I'm wondering if you're tracking. I guess I'd like to know the number of inpatient behavioral health beds that we currently have in the state of Minnesota and where they are located in the districts, where we have them, and the ages that they serve. Because to Representative Hicks' point, I'm very concerned about the children, and I'm very concerned about geriatrics not having psychiatric and behavioral health treatment places when their life is in danger or others. And so that has been a specific facility that model that has existed. And what I hear from healthcare providers and from nurses and doctors is that we're seeing bed closures across the state at a pretty frequent level outside of the DCT. And so I'd like to see an overall picture of a map that shows where we have these behavioral inpatient by age, children, adults, and geriatrics. The other question I have is if you have data that tracks the number of placements that have happened out of state for children, adults, or seniors. I would love to hear that data, because I have concerns on that also, and that would be very helpful, because I believe we have a gap that is going to be shocking to people when we see a map of the state. And Greater Minnesota, I think, is falling through the cracks in significant proportions, and I'd like to see us what we have for the entire state model for all ages right now in place, because the capacity need, we know we have 40% increase in mental health, that's clear, and we have boarding going on in hospitals, and there's reasons why people aren't able to take people to place them. They want to, but they don't have the staff that are either equally trained or available, or and medications have to be available. And so to stop this spiral, I think the data would be helpful to probably every member here. And if it already exists and I don't have it, then my apologies, but I'd love to see it. Thank you.
Commissioner, I think we got a map a long time ago that showed where the DCT sites are and the number of patients. We got a long time ago, but Commissioner, can we get similar data with a more breakdown as requested?
Chair Noor and Rep. Zelenstikar, I'd like to see that too. and I heard you say private providers as well, community providers, not just DCT. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would take some doing, but it would be great to get a sense of that. But it is. But as Rep. Noor also mentioned, there are certainly DCT facilities in many rural communities across the state.
Rep. Zelenstikar.
Thank you, Chair. And to your point, Chair, that's exactly what I'm asking. DCT is one component, but we also have other components that exist. And my understanding is even since last session, we've had hospitals and models that have delicensed or changed their model and are not going to have beds. And so I think the big picture is really important for this committee on the DCT and the total number of people we're serving in all the locations for the needs. Because with their youth needs, they're going to become adult needs. And our goal is to keep them from becoming into the DCT model. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Chair. So the question that maybe you can't fully answer, but maybe you can give us some kind of an indication. So it's, you know, not the first task force that's looked at this. What we want it to be is maybe the last task force that addresses this, and that you've also made mention that there would be a legislation introduced. And knowing that every committee has problems with funding, limited funding, and also limited attention, is there a way that when we look at the specific bills that will help us take advantage of the of you know all the work that went into this report to set priorities in terms of funding, in terms of legislation that needs to be passed that maybe has small amounts but is critical for making an impact on the system so that whatever we can accomplish that we will have put front and center the things that would have the most impact on what the issues are and how they've been identified within the work of the group so that we really take advantage of the work that's been done and respect the work that's been done.
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Rep. Pryor, absolutely. There's a group, I think there's a meeting overlapping with this one where folks are taking the task force report and turning it into bill language. And thank you. We would very much love to see that happen. I've had folks in the behavioral health industry and our counties and tribal nations remind me coming out of the pandemic that now we can get to work on the other pandemic, and that's our behavioral health needs across the state. And so it's clear that it's at that sort of proportion and we need to do what we can. It's really inconvenient that the task force report is coming out in a year when our forecast is slim. And so that's going to be some interesting debate and important and difficult decisions to be made to figure out where to start and how to start. And so we tried to put a few recommendations in that would not affect the budget, and then others that are going to require a significant investment over time. So, but yes, we can try to prioritize those. I was very proud of the task force in sticking with 9 recommendations and not 100 or more. And so I hope that's helpful right off the bat.
Thank you, Commissioner. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. My question is, going back to Representative Quam's question, you know, I was looking at the budget that we passed last year, and, you know, we had an increase of about $210 million, and that was just to maintain current levels. And I'm wondering, you know, you testified last year that of, let's see if I can bring up this number again, of 388 FTEs that we had appropriated money for, only 41 of them had been filled at that time. You're testifying today that it sounds like you're doing better at filling FTEs. I'm wondering if you can help us understand what that looks like. And I know, Chair Knorr, we had discussed the money for DCT last year for the purpose of increasing wages and bringing them up to market rate. And so, you know, you asked that question, and I'm wondering, was that money put into current employees? Is it being used to incentivize bringing on new employees? How is that money being used? How many FTEs are we adding in direct care and treatment versus how many we have appropriated money for?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Knorr and Rep. New Brindley. I would have to get an accounting of the FTEs, and exact that moves all the time, every week. And so I'd have to stop at a moment and take account of that and let you know. I'll get back to you about that. So I appreciate that. But I'm glad you asked about the $210 million investment, because I've also been privileged to go to several openings this year of behavioral health facilities across Minnesota. And so while there have been some that have closed, there are others that have opened, and I've been pleased to see that. And so we can't take account every quarter, but it would be interesting to see if we ended up with a net zero, you know, not up or down over the last year, and see how that goes. And then we can certainly get you. You're talking about the DCT FTE specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
Lead Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And wages. What, you know, what is happening? Is that indeed, I mean, that was the purpose of putting that money into direct care and treatment, was to increase those wages. Is that working? Mm-hmm. Are we attracting additional workforce? You know, to Representative Quam's point, I mean, my concern is we can build buildings all day long. Mm-hmm. But if there are not people to staff those buildings, it is we are throwing money away. That is not a good use of resources. So to expand without a definitive plan, to Representative Fisher's point, on how we are going to bring people in, it's not a real plan. It's just hopes, and it's just aspirational, but it's not an actual plan on how we're going to serve these people. So I think we really do need an accounting of how that additional funding has been used. Is it indeed attracting additional workforce? Is our current workforce being paid more than they were? Because I think that was really the purpose. Those are the things we need to understand, I think, before we make any decisions. I mean, obviously, this year is going to be difficult regardless with a lot of this. But before we make decisions, we need to understand how what we have already done is impacting the current system.
Commissioner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Chair Knorr and Rep. New Brindley. I do remember going to the employee picnic last summer at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, where they announced that on that particular day they had every single position filled at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. So I'm sure the dollars that were appropriated last year went right to work and making sure that we could hire our DCT employees. We also have other ways of increasing capacity besides building buildings. So I mentioned there's the one unit that's been closed, and we're considering now trying again to staff it and to fill it and to open it. The idea of getting people out of DCT who are sitting in those places that need to be out in community to get more people in the front door is really the finest way we can open up capacity. And then there's been some discussion of rearranging some of the services that we have. We've had only one proposal over the last year about building a building. And so we are really talking about trying to get the staffing up for the services that we have now.
Any further questions? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Commissioner?
Well, just thank you very much for your time. And once again, I want to just publicly thank all the members of this task force. It's been a rich and helpful conversation, and everyone understanding each other's perspectives on this. and was really pleased when the group came together and really put in some extra effort at the end to come to 100% agreement on the recommendations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have two testifiers who are part of the task force, Washington County Attorney Kevin Magnuson, and also Human Services Director of Business Operations Blue at County, Angela Youngerberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Knorr.
Good afternoon.
Committee members, my name is Kevin Magnuson, M-A-G-N-U-S-O-N. I'm the Washington County Attorney. I'm on the Executive Committee of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the President of the Urban Association of County Attorneys. I was the MCAA representative on the task force.
Good afternoon, Chair Knorr and committee members. For the record, my name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I was on the task force representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA, and I am also serving as MACSA's president-elect this year.
Welcome, and please proceed with the testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Knorr, committee members. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to address you and talk to this committee. This is a matter that is at the top priority of a number of the county associations that were represented on the task force. There were four of us who represented county interests on the task force. It was myself from the County Attorneys Association. The Sheriff's Association was also represented. The Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators and the Minnesota Association of Counties was also represented. So there were four of us. And this has risen to the top of all of our agendas in terms of number one or number two legislative priorities this year on these at the association level. It is also something that is a very pressing concern for the defense lawyers associations. And I've been in contact with them. You know, whenever you get a bunch of prosecutors and a bunch of defense attorneys to agree, there's something going on. And this is an issue that we care very, very much about. You know, the situation in the jails is as this committee is well aware, is, you know, it's gotten to a point that is just not acceptable. And the thing that was the most concerning for us coming into the task force was that there's a notion that some have that somehow a jail is a better place to hold people. Even people with aggressive behavior than, say, you know, in a hospital or other settings. Jail is a terrible place for someone to be waiting for treatment. You know, when they're untreated, they're decompensating, they're locked in a cell, you know, often in solitary confinement type arrangement, you know, in a situation that, in an institution that was essentially designed, you know, whether we like it or not, it's not my preference, but they're more geared towards punishing than they are towards rehabilitation. And county jails were not meant for long-term detention in any case. But we're talking about people who haven't been convicted of a crime, but they're in a setting that is typically reserved for someone who has been convicted of a crime. So there are serious issues when you have people who are innocent before the law being treated the exact same way as criminals. So coming into this task force, we were very concerned about making sure that there was not some kind of prejudice that said that, you know, a jail is a better institution to hold people while they wait for treatment than a hospital. You know, we understand the challenges that are going on with hospitals, but those cannot be addressed at the expense of the people in jails. So the task force was an amazing opportunity, I think, for discussion and dialogue. Last session, the County Attorneys Association and the Sheriff's Association here at the legislature, you know, trying to strengthen the 48-hour rule, trying to make progress on the long lists of people who are waiting in the wait times. And at the same time, it turns out that DHS was working to, for lack of a better phrase, sort of relax or change the 48-hour rule to a more discretionary standard. At the end of the session, I have to give Senator Hoffman, Chair Hoffman, a ton of credit for putting me and Brad Johnson, the Anoka County Attorney, together with the Commissioner and some of her folks to sit down and have a very difficult conversation at the time. But it was the beginning of a dialogue that I think was incredibly important. You know, she had asked us to come see a hospital, and we said, well, do you want to come see a jail? And as a result, I think we both had our eyes opened to some of the complex challenges that we face. And as a result, having the task force discussion, and I know at the county level, the community services level, there's a lot of interaction with DHS, but you know, at the jails and at the county attorney's level, it's just a kind of a black box. There's no real understanding of what's going on. And having this discussion was really important. And there was a lot of will to try to get to a solution. You know, and maybe some of it was naivete coming into it, not realizing how incredibly complex this issue is. But we came to it because we understood that if the pendulum swings from people waiting in jails and stacking up, you know, to relieve pressure on the hospitals, it only swings back. If you're trying to triage between a finite, unsatisfactory number of resources, the only thing that can happen is a battle, a war between the parties that are trying to survive. And that's exactly what we're going to have here if there is not immediate capacity. And that was the push for the county attorney's block, you know, the four individuals and the defense representative and some others. There simply had to be, for any change to happen, there had to be an expansion of capacity, no matter how you do it in the immediate term. I think staffing is an incredibly important thing, as you discussed earlier, and one of the quickest ways. But some of the other reforms that we talked about are helpful. But there's no way you can really expand capacity in the immediate term without taking some emergency measures to expand the capacity at DCT. And the report was, in fact, unanimous. But without that principle, it would have been very much not unanimous. I mean, there was a large number of people who would not have voted for the report, except for the principle that the two have to be tied together. If you are going to open up capacity for people in hospitals, and I think we all agree that there's some tragic situations there, you have to be opening capacity up for jails as well. You can't just bounce back and forth. You know, so I don't think not funding something, even in this budget year, is really a possibility. And I understand that there are limited resources, and everybody comes to this committee and says the exact same thing. I understand that. But we've been reaching out to the governor and the governor's staff and saying, you know, this has to be a part of the budget. Or, you know, if it's a one-sided solution and all we're doing is triaging, then the consensus will break down at this session, and we'll be back to where we were at the beginning of the last session. Now, one of the things that I wanted to make sure I mention was that the situation in the jails has been really difficult, and our representative from the Sheriff's Association isn't here to address that, so I'll just for a minute pinch hit for him. That's Sheriff Brian Welk from Cass County. And, you know, the jails would like to be able to provide as much treatment as possible, especially at the level of, you're familiar with the Jarvis order type, you know, so the involuntary or involuntary administration of medication. And that's a very difficult situation for jails to do. They don't have the facilities. They're not staffed for it. They're terrified of the idea of what happens if something goes wrong. They don't have the facilities to handle that. People don't really understand what the liability is involved, and I think some of the liability issues are unclear. And so there's a lot of difficulty to get from the point of saying, well, you can administer these kind of medications in jail, to being it actually a practical solution. And so one of the things that the task force spent some time on, and again, it involves funding, but it was to have the DCT and DHS take on the task of funding and training and putting people, licensed, the appropriate people, together with jails and having a standard kind of practice across the board, because if you have 87 counties or, you know, however many county jails there are, you know, there's just going to be a wide discrepancy across the board on how that's implemented in order for it to be effective. That's one of the ways I think we all agree that you can move people really quickly. The other thing I wanted to mention real briefly that we talked about, didn't get a lot of press in the report, but it's very important, I think, is the forensic examiner. There's just a lack of forensic examiner capacity. And frankly, some of the forensic examiners, you know, aren't of the quality, the work that we're seeing isn't of the quality that we need. And so counties are often hiring an additional forensic examiner. But, you know, for our purposes, the scarcity is causing people to wait, you know, sometimes 3 months or longer before they even get to a point where they're waiting on a waiting list. So that's another area to address, I think is relatively straightforward, is to broaden the reach for forensic examiners and the number. Finally, one of the issues that was a big, you know, at the conference committee hearing last year was the issue of litigation. You know, one of the things that the task force and that I was interested in is how do you limit the kind of litigation that the DH has to experience. And the fact is, you know, as long as there are people waiting, there's going to be people who are going to be trying to litigate their constitutional rights. And that's one of the reasons why the transparency aspect was so important, is that people need to see, why is it that I'm way down on the list and somebody else is higher? And if you don't provide them with that, when you're in a jail, you have no recourse other than to file a motion with the court. You know, you can't complain to anybody. You know, there are different avenues with hospitals, but with jails, the only thing you can do is go to a court. And so you see a lot of litigation. You see even judges without litigation ordering, you know, or attempting to order DHS to provide progress reports and to admit people. I would like to say one thing, though, that it's clear, and in the task force, we pointed out that the appellate courts have found, they've never found that in any case as far that that the parties have jurisdiction over the commissioner in a motion or a petition to try to compel the commissioner to do anything. So discussion about the commissioner being held individually, you know, in contempt, I don't think is a realistic thing. But that does not diminish the problem of litigation and the resources that go into that. So with that, my colleague is going to
thank you, County Attorney.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you, and thank you to Kevin for sharing his insights about being on the task force, and also appreciate Commissioner Harpstead's testimony earlier and sharing with you the details of the report. Kevin spoke to the role a bit about the county coalition, so the four county groups that work together. I think it's important to share with you that we did spend considerable time outside of the meetings. This was a very, very fast process, as you're very well aware. And we're very happy that we came to consensus at the end about the recommendations that we could support. We spent considerable time with each other and with each other's associations for the purpose of education. So although we all come from the county background, we all didn't fully understand what each other's worlds were like. And that was critical for all of us to understand the hardships that our entities see, but more so to understand the hardships of the individuals that we're all serving in a different way. And that became really part of the cornerstone of the county coalition working together. In addition to the guiding principle that we came to as a group, which is that all people are entitled to have mental health care, we want to underscore that people who have been civilly committed should also have access to the court-ordered treatment that they require to achieve recovery. So that is really at a different level. There's a civil commitment process. There is a higher need identified. We also, as a county group, succeeded in including the principle that jails are not a replacement for mental health hospitals or secure treatment facilities. We understand that there are reasons that people need to be in jails, but that is not to build out jails to become pseudo-treatment centers. That is not their design. It's not what they're intended to be. One key objective was to ensure that any steps to mitigate the problems that hospitals face, and hospitals are facing very, very difficult, challenging situations, no doubt about it, but that those steps to mitigate those problems do not come at an expense of the people in jails where they have no chance to access inpatient mental health services. Kevin said it very, very well in his testimony. I would highlight that the findings in the report included recognition that the priority admission statute was a response to the lack of access of inpatient capacity at DCT that still persists today. So 10 years ago, we were having these same conversations. And here we are, and acknowledging that capacity continues to be a concern. With the significant and increased demand for services, which the report outlines very, very clearly, there is just more demand. It's not surprising that DCT does not have adequate capacity for even the most acutely ill people. The report contains data that shows that trends are not likely to change without significant action. And so there's chart after chart in the report that outlines the increasing trend and the availability of resources not keeping up with that demand. Having had the privilege of working within Minnesota's mental health system for many years, I've seen great successes, especially in building community-based care. And I've also witnessed the inpatient and residential systems become overwhelmed with demand. And so when we look at the DCT system as a continuum, we have community-based inpatient care known as CBHHs over here. And the length of stay, if you're not familiar with that, I like to characterize that as people will go there for weeks to sometimes months to receive the treatment that they need at those community behavioral health hospitals. Then we have Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center for more acutely ill individuals. And the length of stay, I like to characterize that as people are there for months receiving the support that they need. And they're able to work with individuals that have higher behavior needs. And then over here, we have the forensic program. And in the forensic program, there are specific criteria that need to be met for an individual to be hospitalized at that level. But it's important to know that the length of stay is much, much longer than the CBHHs or Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. We're talking years. I believe the last I heard was the average length of stay there was 7 years. So there's not a flow in, flow out necessarily problem. There is a capacity problem because people are not being discharged very quickly from that facility because of their circumstances, their illness, and their high, high level of need. Our system is so overwhelmed that the populations and programs that are supposed to treat are kind of spilling into the next is what's happening until forensics is full, which is where what we're seeing right now. And then because the state must prioritize that population, it turns backwards. And we've got individuals who would normally historically have been served in forensics being served at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center waiting a bed. And as a result, people at AMRTC, they're predominantly people waiting for forensics. And most everyone else who requires that level of care at AMRTC waits. That's what happens. And that causes the backlog in the jails and in the hospitals. The 48-hour rule was enacted to protect the constitutional rights of people in jail that were court-ordered to receive the treatment that they needed. And it worked. It really did. When you look at the data, it worked for about 10 years until the demand for forensic services truly exceeded the capacity. And the report outlines there are many reasons for that. Many, many reasons beyond our control. Changing the law should happen, but not without an expansion of inpatient, residential, and community-based bed and service capacity. Community capacity, specifically with secure residential treatment known as ERTS, is desperately needed. This would offer people a place to transition to when coming out of AMRTC, but also be an option that would prevent hospitalization in some cases. So this is one solution that's listed on the recommendations that is a front end and back end solution. It really does and potentially could help in both ways. But once the law does change, as Kevin talked about, the pendulum will swing. It will swing. and the risk of it swinging too far is real. Without additional resources, we will only be frustrated as a system by the result. I've witnessed direct care and treatment staff and leadership do an exceptional job of improving processes and making efficient and effective use of existing resources and program capacities. It's time, overdue actually, for additional resources. DCT must be allowed to expand hospital capacity and focus on forensic bed and staffing capacity. And the state must expand community resources for people transitioning out of higher levels. Counties strongly urge you to support the recommendation to permanently relieve counties of the does not meet criteria costs when a person is waiting for transfer to a state facility, as counties have no ability to influence this reality. With wait lists being months long at times, this is a significant financial hardship to counties with no return. We eagerly await the governor releasing his budget and hope that it will recognize to seek and address the need for expanded capacity at DCT and community resources. In the task force, I recall Attorney General Ellison commenting that given the current situation, resources will be expended on this topic. It's just whether it will be on capacity and community building or costly litigation. There's an urgency to act on the issue. I'd like to underscore three items. That number one, counties worked collaboratively on this task force to improve the recommendations that Commissioner Harpstead just presented, and we support them. Capacity increase must be the top priority, and no policy change should happen without that capacity increase in DCT and in the community. And we need action with urgency. We hope the governor asks for this investment, but we need the legislature to recognize that need too and make the investment. DHS may not have asked for this capacity increase in the past, but the report does ask for it, and we ask for it. I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you so much, County Attorney Magnuson, and also Director Youngerberg, for your service and for the recommendation that you have provided us. And we look forward to working together to find the right solution as we wait for the February focus in the next few days and see where we can go from here. And I think there's more to ask in this process. I'll start with Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some years ago, I was part of the Zed Governing Board. And we had multiple school districts. They're too small to be able to staff for special needs. So you couldn't hire a .3, a .2. So we got together and hired and then shared across so that these days, this week, you know, you had a professional come in. I wonder if when you're talking about the jails and different settings where from week to week there's a need or greater need or lesser need, that if you had some of a cooperative staffing, you know, regionally or however you want to base it, that could come in and, you know, give the supports, the special needs, that might be a way that you could handle that delivery without having a permanent structure and staff. Because that flexibility, I think, is what's really needed. And so maybe you could look at how have other entities utilized cooperative efforts to provide the needed personnel and, you know, whatever the, you know, program or whatever you need to do. Because I don't think you need to reinvent the wheel. You just need to see how has somebody done it that we can plagiarize and do an effective job. The other thing is back when the state hospitals closed, there was the plan to have regional centers. And that never really came to fruition. Part of it was staffing. So again, if you can look between maybe the prisons, the jails, counties, some state staff, and regionally set up that cooperative staffing, I know there are a lot of empty or underutilized, shall we say, facilities across the state that instead of building new, you might be able to
add some modifications to be able to use them as needed. So I hear a lot of, well, we need to do this general thing, but I want to see a list of options and possibilities of how we could implement, and that would allow implementation in parts of the greater Minnesota that aren't quite the model of the metro. So just a little bit of suggestion.
Mr. Chair, may I address?
Yes, go ahead, County Attorney Magnuson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think the points that you make are very well taken, and they were things that we considered in the task force. I can't speak on behalf of Sheriff Welk, who is the sheriff's representative. I will say that he spent a lot of time talking about the desire to do exactly that. I think the problem that they run into is, while there may be some space and there may be some resources, very few, even on a regional basis, have the facility to be able to provide the kind of treatment that we're talking about. So there is cooperation going on, and there's plans for additional cooperation, but sometimes the facilities are just inadequate in an entire region to be able to, to do the kind of treatment that we're talking about. And so I think that was what they were gearing part of the request for, is how can we set that up, at least one facility, and then have a regional hub for that in the jail.
Director Engelberg.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I would just like to speak to that as well. A couple of years ago, there was a legislative report that brought to light that there's some confusion in the law about whether or not a Jarvis order can be enforced in a jail. And to some really good work by the legislature, within the past year or two, I believe that law was changed to provide clarity that can be enforced in the jail. However, it's not been adopted very widely because there are still many questions remaining, and some of the workforce, the procedural pieces that Mr. Magnuson spoke about are real. The cooperative staffing is something that was discussed in the task force. We had a small work group that met outside of the task force because we felt that this was such a discussion that required additional elevation, and we wanted to come to agreement again on very short terms to what that might look like without fully developing an operational model. The department has provided some resources to us in terms of what other states have been doing, and so I know the Direct Care and Treatment has provided information of what California is doing in this very exact subject, and one of the findings was that the state funding was critical for it, so that there's consistency in application from jail to jail instead of 87 different ways of it looking. So if a person ends up in jail in one jail or transfers to the next, their care doesn't look different. And so there's a lot that we can learn, that we can operationalize based on what others have done. And I think, really the next piece of this is spending time in education and exploration of what those creative things would look like. One of the recommendations is that DHS, DCT would be assisting with providing some of that consistency. And I think that would really, really help. I do see that this could truly prevent the need for hospitalization. I can say with specificity that in Blue Earth County, we have had an individual who was on the wait list for months end up in Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, finally received the medication, and within 2 to 3 weeks was ready for discharge. I mean, really, it was just a medication intervention, not the entire treatment component that was needed. And so that is a very effective tool. There are pieces that we need to get through to be able to do that, and I think your cooperative staffing model is right down the lane of what has been discussed.
Mr. Chair, just a quick thing. There are several counties that have built new facilities. In the process of doing that, they have talked with and discussed so they can be an overflow. So they have some, and if you worked in there, that in the facility, some of the facilities may be more adaptable to building an area or space that could be utilized like this, and so you could have designated locations within X distance and have agreements amongst two, three counties, whatever like that. So it's not just staffing. You could have a facilities agreement. Mm-hmm. And good luck. Let us know.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Quam. I have Representative Hicks, Franson, and Baker. So we'll start with Hicks, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you so much for being here, both of you, today. I heard you speak around the prevention component. I heard a lot of that. No, that wasn't the goal of the task force. What do you see as the biggest indicator or biggest bang for our buck, I guess, in the prevention space? Because you talked about the whole continuum. And so I know the commissioner spoke about the rate study, which we had a presentation on pre-session. And so just trying to understand, given all of the ideas that have come forward, what is sort of the biggest bang for our buck in the prevention space?
Ms. Jengerberg.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. It's a really good question. We have on the recommendation with the community-based cares is where my mind goes to. Prevention, obviously, in the jails in terms of delivering medication, I think is a significant stride forward that really would not cost that much to be. It's really, we should be looking at providing medication for people with mental illness, especially an injectable medication, the same way that we would be delivering a diabetes medication to someone is really how we should be looking at that. And there are some barriers that we need to get through before we get to that point. On the community-based side, I would really put my eggs in the basket of the Secure ERTS option. DCT has a couple of different secure facilities, or they have flex locks is what they call them, where they're able to take individuals that have higher behaviors and needs, but they are not ready to come into the community yet fully in terms of either, you know, living independently or living in a group home. But that ERTS provides them that residential-based treatment. It also provides them some stability for a longer period of time, either as a prevention of going into the hospital or coming out of the hospital, demonstrating stability, demonstrating health, demonstrating all of those things that make it easier to transition back into the community. So I probably go to that one, you know, off the top of my head in terms of prevention, because it works both ways. It can be the step before someone would need to be hospitalized for a longer period of time, and we can be preventative in that way. I also think a number of the items on the list really would not cost very much, but would have a lot of bang for their buck in terms of the voluntary engagement services and some of those pieces, because those, you could pilot that and look at the efficacy of it. It wouldn't take that much, but we know that when we pilot something, we can study and use data and see what happens. And that would be a very low cost thing that could in time potentially yield significant results.
Thank you. We have 4 minutes, and I have Representative Franson and Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So just kind of listening to this, you know, last session we spent $28 billion, if you factor in the surplus and tax increases. So that's $28 billion, 40% growth in Minnesota government. And yet here we are facing a budget deficit that we're waiting for in February. So, Mr. Chair, within the DHS budget that was passed in 2023, can you give this body an idea of where extra funds are going to be found? Is this issue here, funding issue, isn't going to be the only funding issue we hear this legislative session? And I think we as members should have an idea if there's a plan, what bucket we're going to be looking at to fund some of these important topics.
That's a great conversation. I know most of the funds that we allocated to the Department of Human Services has been put to work, and we're looking to see where we may be able to get other resources. We're waiting for the February focus, which is within the next few days, and we can start having the conversation with leadership in terms of putting this issue as a priority as we have the discussion today. So stay tuned. We'll have that conversation after the February focus and figure out how we can move ahead. So otherwise, I think every funding that we have allocated to the Department of Human Services will have a more connection. I think we've already started the conversation since the beginning of session, so we'll continue to do that. We'll keep you updated in where the accounts are. We will, you know, help this committee decide, you know, what we can do next. Any follow-up question as we come to conclude to the testifiers? Any closing comments?
I just really appreciate your time and attention to this very important topic. The report, we were very happy to come to consensus on the report, and there is a significant amount of data and information contained within. So again, I just appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Chair. I have no additional comments.
Thank you so much, members. We don't have any further agenda items, but I wanted to remind the committee that we're not going to have a hearing on Tuesday, 27, because of the caucuses. Our next meeting will be February 29th. With that, we're now adjourned.